Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me is Armin Navabi. Armin, how are you?
Good, good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you? Oh, well, yeah, we've done that.
Yes.
Yeah, there's... today's topic, it's been 10 years since the Arab Spring. In 2011, many of you know, the Arab Spring happened, started in Tunisia. A lot of dictators, entrenched dictators, who'd been in power for decades, like Ben Ali from Tunisia, Hosni Mubarak from Egypt, Gaddafi, they were all essentially removed by protesters, by the pressure of the people. And the people were very optimistic about this. You know, they thought, okay, this is like a major sea change that's happening in the Middle East. But then it all started to go downhill. And that's what we're going to kind of talk about here is that,
when you scheduled the stream, and now right after you scheduled the stream, it turned to almost all to actually all, which is weird. Like I didn't at first. Like I was like, did you schedule the stream because of what happened in Tunisia? And we're like, no, you did it before what happened in Tunisia, and it just so happened that the final nail in the coffin seems to be apparent. Like, well, we'll discuss it more in detail.
Yeah,
but like we were like, oh, it failed everywhere except Tunisia. And now we're like, never mind. It also failed in Tunisia. Just right after, I don't understand the coincidence. Like there's such a coincidence. Like right after you planned this stream, Tunisia went down as well. I mean, we don't know yet, but we don't know.
Yeah, that's the thing. We don't know. I mean, Tunisia is kind of, it's up in the air. It's obviously unstable. There have been protests and there's been unrest going on in Tunisia for several months now. I mean, there's been, they have a really bad, the pandemic hit them really, well, sorry, we gotta talk about that crap. Okay.
Yeah. All right, we're gonna say the P word. We're gonna refer to it as the P.
That hit the big P. Yeah, and then their rollout was really, really bad. Unemployment is through the roof. Young people are very frustrated. There's economic issues. So this has been brewing for a while. But what's happened now is that the president Tunisia.
Before we get to Tunisia, can we have like a broader perspective? Like I want to like look at the whole thing and then focus on Tunisia. Okay.
Yeah.
Because so, I remember this 10 years ago, there was so much hope over this. Like people were like, this is it. This is the, you know how the name of our podcast is like for an age of enlightenment. This is like, you know, that age of enlightenment that was supposed to come to the Muslim world. This was it. Like this was, we thought like, this is like, all of the things that we saw in Europe in the 18th century and everything that came after, this is the beginning of it. Like, we're like, oh my God, look, it's happening. Finally, it's happening. And people were so hopeful. People were like, democracy, freedom, justice, it's here. It's happening. The world is progressing. It happened in Europe and now it's happening here. Yay, yeah. Down with dictators. And now look at it. Look how naive and hopeful and pathetic we look. Like, oh my God, like, you're good.
But here's the thing. So, you know, whatever happened in Europe, it took a very, very long time, right? So here we're talking about a 10-year mark. And there are many people in the Middle East and there's many who don't think that this is a failure. They think we're speaking too soon. They think that this is something, it's a process that's still ongoing. Like, for instance, in 2019, what happened? Like the two other dictators that were brought, the Algerian in Algeria and in Sudan, right? There was the protests and then the power of the people actually brought down two other leaders there. And that's what they were calling the second.
That was not part of the original Arab Spring. So let's like look at all the countries,
right? No, but Armin, Sorry, let me just clarify. What I was saying is that because they think this is a process, it wasn't part of the original Arab Spring in 2011, but they're saying it's an ongoing process. So the 2019 thing is,
I understand. But just to understand, I'm not saying that, I wasn't suggesting that this was a failure. I'm actually going to make the argument for why you shouldn't give up already, right? But I'm just like telling, like, what it feels like. Is like, yep, no, the Arab Spring was like, we lost, like, this is like a failure, pack up, you know, democracy was defeated, pack up everything and go home. Okay, that's what it feels like, right? Yeah. But let's look at, let's take the main countries that were originally involved, like the second one that came later, but that's another thing. But look at, it started in Tunisia, right?
Right.
Then, I don't know if I'm getting the order right, but I think then it was Egypt, right. Then it was Syria. Oh yeah, Libya, and then Syria, and also it also got into Bahrain and Yemen, right? Mm-hmm. So we had some dictators being removed. Ben Ali in Yemen, right?
Ben Ali in Tunisia.
Saleh in Yemen. In Egypt, we had Mubarak being removed, and then Morsi coming and. You know, we had elections, and then people chose the Muslim Brotherhood, and people were like, what?
Yeah.
Oh, actually, I need to. And then the army came in and then removed the elected government and brought back the dictatorship. So Egypt seemed like such an obvious failure because the authoritarian new regime was even worse than what Mubarak was like. So we had. Mubarak was removed, Morsi was elected, which is the Muslim Brotherhood, and then Sisi came into power, and Sisi seems more authoritarian than Mubarak ever was, so wow. Syria seemed like so hopeful, like people were in the streets, and they're like, okay, Assad is falling, and then Assad came out with such force against its own people that was like unbelievable. Like it was so hard to even believe that the international world could just watch that happening. And it just let it happen. So it was the same thing in Libya. Gaddafi was like unleashed against his people, but he failed. Assad didn't fail because he had the support of
Iran and Russia,
right? Bahrain also had people rebelling against it. That one was the one that Iran's government was very excited about because that, you know. So it's very interesting. Like Bahrain and Syria are kind of the mirror image of each other, right? Mm-hmm. So in Syria, we had a Shia regime that people protest against the authoritarian Shias in charge, although it was secular, but still was Shias in charge. And Iran was like, no, sorry, people. No democracy for you. This is our buddy. These are our buddies here. So we're going to come in and, you know, crush the dissent. In Bahrain, though, Iran was like, oh, yeah, dissent. Topple the dictator, everybody, because Bahrain was like a Sunnis ruling over Shias.
Yeah.
So it was in Iran's interest for that to happen. And Saudi Arabia was like, no, these are our buddies. No democracy for you. We're going to send in our troops. So Iran sent troops to defend Assad, and Saudi Arabia sent troops to defend the dictators in Bahrain. So the dissent in Bahrain and in Syria was crushed by foreign regimes that had interest there. Mm-hmm. In Yemen, So basically Syria and Bahrain, the dictators were not removed. In Egypt, the dictators were removed and were replaced with another dictators, kind of like a Napoleon situation. In Yemen, also the dictator was removed. Oh, Yemen and Libya are like each other kind of, because the dictator in Yemen, the dictator was Saleh, and I mean technically he was a dictator even though he was elected and all, because he wouldn't leave ever, but both of those turn into like forever civil wars after, right? Like the removal of the dictators in Yemen and Libya resulted in conflict forever until now, and people might be like, you know, this is not like, we don't like dictators, but we don't like this chaos as well, right? So Libya and Yemen are like each other. Bahrain and Syria are like each other, the mirror image of each other. Egypt was like kind of like the French Revolution, a dictator being replaced by a worse dictator, like a more authoritarian dictator. And Tunisia was the only success story until 2 days ago, right?
Yeah,
Tunisia was the only success story. People were like, everybody was like, you know what? Tunisia is a role model. everybody was like, you know what? Yes, we had all these failures, but if it's possible in Tunisia, it should be possible in everywhere else. And people were like, look, the revolutionary hope still is there because we made it happen in Tunisia. You know, and now that one is also being challenged. But go on.
That's a good question. Yeah, so the thing is, one of the problems, you're right about the rise in authoritarianism. So this is the autocrats. I mean, these are even more deadly autocrats that have come into place, like Sisi came in Egypt. And there are a lot of political dissidents who have been killed. Like, I think during Mubarak's time, there were a few thousand political prisoners. Now there's like tens of that. I think something over 10,000 political prisoners. There were thousands of people who were killed around 2013, 2014. In Egypt, and in Iraq, actually, just last year, just in the last few months, there are about 500, 600 protesters who've been killed. Okay, so they're really cracking down. The one thing that they've shown is like to demoralize. Well, Assad, you know, like he's it's close to, like, I think the estimates say 500,000 or more, like over 500,000 people have died there. And then this Arab Spring is actually connected to like what happened in Syria, the uprising against Assad that created, and other places, created loads of refugees. These refugees went up to Europe. That led to this whole reactionary movement in Europe. And then you had like these other sort of these right-wing governments coming up. So this is not something that was just localized to that region. I mean, you have, you know, the Brexit and even, you know, the election of Trump and all of these things are related to some of the events that happened in the Arab Spring, the refugee crisis, and then the formation of ISIS and all of that stuff. So all of these things coming together had global impact. It had an effect on how the Europeans chose their leaders, how the Americans chose their leaders. It really bled out everywhere. So this has been a very complex thing. And the new dictators have cracked down on protesters, and they've shown that they can quash with a lot of military force. They can quash their own people. They can quash movements. I mean, this is that's the downside. Now, there is a slight, maybe small plus side, is that the new dictators that are in power are trying, for whatever reason, right? And, you know, their intentions aren't always good, but they are trying to help modernize and listen to the people in the way that people want things. Like, you know, MBS is an example, you know? Allowing women to drive, and, you know, like for whatever it's
worth. Oh, no, I'm not going to let
you. No. It's a very, hold on. It's a very minor thing. And I know it's related to his vision through 2000 and run out of oil. And, you know, everybody, he wants foreign investment, all of these other things. And he's using it as a cover to hide his bigger crimes. But this is something that's happening throughout. I mean, there's issues that are happening in 2019, the Algerian Sudan, like the unemployment in the Middle East, I just read this, is 36.5% right now. And the majority of the population, over 70%, is under the age of 35, right? So it's...
I just need to counter that, because that is completely not right. Like, it's not that they're listening to their people. It's they're desperate for survival, and also is the authoritarianism has increased, not decreased. It's not like Ellie. So if I start beating my wife and then tell her that, you know what, that purse that you wanted, I'm going to buy it for you. Right. This is not progress. Right. Like people, like we can't, I mean, I know like you're not saying that, but we can't describe this as them being listening to their people more. We can describe this as them being more responsive to people's demands. It's the exact opposite of that. They're tightening their grips. So these are just like for me, like some of these acts is just for media consumption. These are not. I mean, and I know that you know about these other things that are happening. I just have a problem with describing it as them being more responsive to the people.
Sure,
it's the opposite. Yeah.
I think that there's like this sort of next generation, like this idea of throughout the Middle East. I mean, you're seeing these politicians. I mean, it's still not grassroots. It's not the people, but you're seeing these people in these monarchies and these royal families and everything coming down, and they're labeling themselves as reformers. Like they want to reform the political system. They want to reform the government. They want to make it less corrupt. They want to make it more accountable. And in some places, at least to the people, right? It's encouraging to the people. Now, whether they're
they're doing the opposite. They're doing the opposite.
There's the autocrats and these sort of reform people. They're not as visible. They're the ones who are actually like, this is happening in several countries. Like this thing wasn't there before. Before you had like Saddam Hussein and you had Tariq Aziz, right? But now you have these sort of reform parties that are trying to like reform things.
Where? Right?
It's all over the place. Hold on, let me find it. I'll tell you.
All right, let me actually give you a better way to be hopeful, because right now, you know, Tunisia was a government that had multiple parties that were actual real oppositions competing with each other. That was it. The other ones did not have that. And Tunisia, now we have like a coup, could be described as a coup. What's happening, right? We'll get into more details about what's happening in Tunisia, but like the current president is completely dismissive of all the parties as a whole, and he doesn't like the anyways, we'll get to Tunisia later, okay? But here's a better way to be hopeful about what's happening, okay? If you want a silver lining, if you look at, again, this is, I'm just saying that this is possible, I'm not saying this is what's happening, okay? Just so that people have something to hang on to, okay?
Right.
Just let me finish. If you look at, like, for example, if I'm giving you one example, this is not a proof that it's going to happen, right? Because it's just an example. So I'm using anecdotal, like a sample size of like one or two. So obviously this is not a way to conclude things, but it's when you're using, Ali, you don't need to say when I'm talking, okay? When you use a sample, when you use a sample size of one, which what happens is that instead of saying that therefore this is going to happen, what you're actually saying is that look at what's possible, look at the things that are possible, right? And if you look at, for example, the French Revolution, right, it seemed like it backfired, right? It seemed like, I mean, it did actually, you know. It backfired in a way that it was supposed to bring power to the people. It was supposed to bring open the door for enlightenment values. It was supposed to give people justice, you know, representation in government, freedom of expression, and all the good stuff, equality, blah blah blah, all of that, right? And it got a whole bunch of people killed. The French Revolution, and the people who were in charge of revolution were actually some of the most brutal people. They couldn't stop chopping heads off. Even their own allies, all of a sudden, everybody that disagreed with them started, like, this was like a revolution that was supposed to bring power to the people. And all of a sudden it turned into everyone's head being chopped off, even if they slightly disagreed with you, right? And then eventually it led to a authoritarian being coming into power that was even more authoritarian than the people who were removed. It had absolute power. So people, if you looked at it back then, you were like, okay, well, this was a failure. This was an absolute failure. But if you look back, if you look at it a long term after, you were like, I mean, it opened the door to a culture of protest, a culture of the idea that people could hope for, like, it's possible to bring these people down, right? These people are not sitting there because God has chosen them, and it's, you know, the people have the power. It is possible for people to bring punishment upon the people who are oppressing them. Like, it's a possibility, right? And fighting for justice and freedom and equality and all that stuff could potentially bring down the people who are against it, right? And just making it a habit of demanding these things, like creating a culture where people demand these things, eventually led to these enlightenment values becoming the norm, even if it didn't look like it in the short term, right? So I'm not saying that's what's going to happen. It really depends on what future generations or the current people in these countries what their perception is of what happened, right? Are they going to feel like, well, we managed to like take down dictators once. These new people are not representing us. We did it once. We could do it again. Like, we could keep trying until we get it right. Or are they going to feel more like, this was a failure. Let's not do that again, right? Yeah. Like, if they feel like, you know, this idea of protesting, it failed. The results were not good, right? So I think it really depends on what is the take-home message. The results depend on what the take-home message is.
Yeah, I think that there's a mindset that they can influence these dictators in a way that they couldn't before, right? And so that's what I'm saying, like, some of these, like, these reform parties and that, or even with the MBS case, right? Like, when you talk to people in Saudi Arabia, there's many people who see through it, but there are a lot of people who actually are encouraged by the things that he's doing. I mean, you're going to say that they're falling for it. In Saudi Arabia, there are a lot of young people who are encouraged by the changes that MBS is bringing about. They may be misinformed. You may say that, okay, they're naive and they're not they're falling for, you know, his tricks and everything. That's fine. But
I'm talking about reality.
Yeah, I know. But I'm also talking about a general atmosphere and a mindset that has normalized protests. That has normalized these people. I mean, yes, they've been killed for it. They've been shot for it. But the leaders are prepared for it. And the young people know that it is a way that you can potentially get things done, even though the cost might be really high.
And that's exactly why Saudi Arabia is not going in that direction, right? Because Saudi Arabia, the people in charge there want to understand that no matter what happens, don't normalize protests, right? If people send them oil money in their at home, like you saw,
right,
like make them empty, give them empty promises and stuff. Just don't let people come up with the idea that they're allowed to like, even when you give them rights, even when you let them drive, the people who ask for, you know, make sure the people who ask for it stay in jail and or pay a heavy price for it, right? So this is why Saudi Arabia is actually going backwards, because the idea is like, at whatever cost, do not create a culture of protest or dissent, right?
Yeah,
and this is why some of these empty promises or these show things is not helping Saudi Arabia, and it's actually keeping it back, right?
Yeah, the reason that Saudi Arabia is doing that, and they're trying to, MBS is trying to do, even though he's taken more control over the country than any other leader before, but the reason that he's doing it is because he knows that there is a mindset of protest, that younger people right now are susceptible to going out and doing that. So he's throwing them, you know, little bits of fruit to just keep them satisfied for a little bit, so that to prevent them from protesting. But he is reacting to that mindset that's already there.
A mindset that exists there less than before, given how brutally he oppresses even his own family and people that are in power, right? So again, that's why I think Saudi Arabia is actually going backwards, not forward. I do want to talk a little bit about, I mean, by the way, that could change at any moment. Look, you know, Saudi Arabia is like very fragile right now with the price of oil and everything. I don't know what's going to happen, right? I mean, if you're going to see protests in Saudi Arabia, it would be, you know, it would be very much in the interest like of Iran's government for it to happen in the Shia oil-rich area of Saudi Arabia. That's another whole other thing. Like, I don't... It's possible that even if we ever see protests in Saudi Arabia, it might have a more of a religious anti-Sunni tone than a pro-democracy. It's like a anti-tyranny in a Hussein versus Yazid kind of feel, more than a more modern enlightenment pro-democracy kind of feel. We'll see. Oh, actually, this is very interesting. If you want to categorize the ideologies that exist within this whole region, what we have is a competition between monarchs, right? So we have, I'm going to use these words and it's going to seem out of place, but I'll explain it, right? We have secular monarchs, right? And we have, okay, I'm hearing a little bit echo. So secular monarchs, we have secular military regimes, right? And then we have Islamic democracies, right? I think that those are the three main ones right now, okay? And then we have secular democracies, right? So Islamic democracies, secular democracies, military tyrants or monarchy tyrants, right? Like, so the idea is that the people who are tyrants, right, they want to send a message to the whole world that if you get democracy, if you look at the people who are in Qatar or more in UAE or in Saudi Arabia or in Egypt, the people who don't have democracies, right? Qatar is an exception. Remove that one. They want to send the message that you do not want to encourage democracy here, okay? Their main reason for what they say that is because that will go against their interests because they're tyrants themselves. But the message that they're sending is like, do you guys want Islam? Do you guys want Islam? Because that's what you're going to get if you get democracy here, okay? And they're like, look at Egypt. You give people a chance to choose, and they chose Islam. Okay, it might seem weird for people to feel like, really, you think like Saudi Arabia and UAE, they're threatening the world with, oh, you want Islam? You don't encourage democracy here because you're gonna get Islam. But that's actually what they're doing. That's their message. Like, people will choose Islam, so that's why you need us. You need secular monarchs, and yes, I'm calling Saudi's regime secular. If people disagree, we could argue about that. Or like, if you look at the Assads or the Sisis, these are secular tyrants, right? Okay. They're like, the message to the world is that you need Sisis, you need monarchs like Saudi Arabia, because you wouldn't like what you get if people choose. All right, but then Tunisia was an example for people to be like, no, look, people could choose like a democracy where the Islamists and the secularists could work like side by side without Islamizing everything so much. I mean, it's still Islamized a lot, but not compared to like, I don't know, what Morsi would have done or the Muslim Brotherhood would. Basically, Saudi Arabia likes to like has the picture of like Muslim Brotherhood symbol and be like, boo, like, you want democracy? That's what you're going to get. You're going to get Muslim Brotherhood. Like, so scared of everybody. Like, and also, Ali, this actually works very well with the narratives of the radicals, right? The ISIS and other groups, people be like, look, guys, they don't want democracy for you, okay? These other countries who are telling you like, ah, yay, let's bring democracy. They give you democracy and then you choose Islam and they're like, oh, sorry, you chose wrong. Let's go back to tyranny, right? They're like, and this is why the radicals, they're like, okay, guys, if you want Islam, you have to get it our way, right? You have to get it by force, because when you choose it, like this whole democracy experiment, you know, it's a failure. This is a West. This doesn't go with Islam. So the Muslim Brotherhood is like a competing ideology with these other radical groups, right? Because the Muslim Brotherhood is like, we can get Islam through elections and presidents and prime ministers and parliaments and all of that stuff, right? And these other radicals are like, those are not Islamic concepts. Those are Western concepts. And look what happened. You did everything. You had the most major success in bringing Muslim. Nowhere had Muslim Brotherhood has had a better success than in Egypt, finally getting one of the most populated, most... The largest Arab country in the world was under the Muslim Brotherhood hand. And they're like, you got it. People chose you. Look what happened. Right after you chose that, it was taken away from you. So choose our way, okay? So ISIS was like, choose our way because democracy will not give you Islam. However, ISIS also failed. So they're, I should say, damn it.
It's okay.
So they also failed. So their marketing is down the drain as well. So people are just hopeless. Oh, another thing, a lot of people might think that this is a fight between, right now, right now, if you think, like, what do people want? Is this a fight between Islamism and secularism, right? Even though a lot of the narrative seems to be like that, right? It's not like that anymore as much. People are just hungry, okay? People are just like, we just want somebody competent to manage things properly. Like, the narrative of the fight between secularism and Islamism is still there, but it's, especially after the pandemic and everything, it has taken a backseat over, like, can we just get somebody that knows how to run the economy, that just, like, is competent, that just fights against corruption, anybody. We don't care what affiliate, religious affiliation. Yeah, that's the mood right now, but go on.
Yeah, that's what, like, even within these dictators, like, you have these sort of reform leaders that are coming in within these establishments as well. And what you're saying is interesting, because they're not wrong. Like, these people who say that if you get rid of the secular dictators, you're going to get Islamic parties, they're not wrong, because what's happened for decades while all of these dictators have been in power, the only people who had the courage, or essentially the balls, to organize a proper oppositional effort against these dictators were the Islamic parties. They're the only ones. Like, there were all these other sort of subgroups as well. I mean, you saw that in Iran too, in the Iranian Revolution, right? Ultimately, when you have an opposition to a dictatorship, even if there are many other different parties, the one that's usually the most organized and that's most coherent is the Islamic party. And that it's been like that throughout the Arab world. I mean, you had the Muslim Brotherhood there in Syria. You also had opposition. The main opposition was a lot of these Islamist parties. So this has been the story pretty much throughout the Middle East. These are the only people who were there to organize. So when these dictators come down after, like, Gaddafi, 40 years in power, you know, Mubarak, I think a few decades in power, when they come down, then that vacuum is immediately filled by these people who already have this great organizational structure that they've been building for years. Right? So it isn't surprising that that would happen.
Yeah. Yeah, we do need to talk about Tunisia and then also go to Patreon questions. Okay. So what is interesting about Tunisia is that we are still deciding as of now if this is a coup or not. We can't. So if people don't know what happened, is that just right after we scheduled this stream, Tunisia just broke. Well, I mean, so the president just came out and be like, yeah, we're not going to let the prime minister into the parliament. People are not happy with the prime minister, especially with his response to the pandemic, and everybody's upset. So I, as the president, I'm just going to decide on my own that the prime minister is no longer the prime minister. I'm just like, by what authority? Like, just going to, oh, he keeps talking about the constitution. Like, I get to do this because it's the constitution, but the constitution clearly says that he needs to talk to the prime minister before he could do something like that. So people are like, yeah, this is a coup of this. And he's like, no, it's not a coup. It's right in the constitution. And people are like, oh, this is a coup. So now apparently it seems like the decision on whether this is a coup or not is going to be dependent on what happens in the next month, whether he's going to allow another, prime minister to come in and the parliament to open or not. And people are like, okay, if you don't let this happen, then this definitely is a coup. Right now people are fighting over what this is, right? But he's also somebody who didn't like the parliamentary system to begin with. He wanted he wants more like a presidential system. So people are like, aha, we see what you're doing, because you already said that you want this. But he's like, nope, I'm going to let a new prime minister come in. And also the prime minister, who's now been removed by the president, he also at first was like, yeah, I don't like this, but now he's like, okay, whatever, I will support whoever he picks. Like, so he's like, he's stepping back, he's not even resisting, right? He's just accepting it, right? So I don't know what's going to happen. People, it could be as bad as this president all of a sudden becoming an authoritarian and taking all the power for himself without the people actually choosing it. And actually the reaction to this has been very mixed. At first, it seemed like people were like, yeah, this is fantastic. This was the right choice. The prime minister sucks. He's been very bad. But now some people also are coming out and saying, like, what the hell is happening? This is not the will of the people. This is not the way we do things. You can't just come and take power without the people giving you the authority to do that. So this is a coup. So there's some mixed reactions. And it could be as bad as this is being a coup and the president trying to get the power to his hand. All of it. Or it could actually, like, maybe a month from now, we look back at this and like, okay, it wasn't as bad as we thought. Like, it's bad, but it does seem like Tunisia is broken. But hey, he managed to bring a new prime minister, and it's good. It's all chill now, right? It could be anything in between. However, even if it's as bad as like a full on coup, it is bad, but it's not like Egypt bad. You know what I mean? Like, this is like, a lot of people are comparing this to like what happened in Egypt, and be like, it's like they're comparing this guy to like a Sisi takeover of what People's Choice, and like, but it's not that bad. It's not that, it doesn't seem like Tunisia doesn't have the capacity to go that bad. But go on.
Well, there's also another really, really big difference between the Tunisia and the Egypt thing. Like, in Egypt, Sisi came in. Sisi was the defense minister. Like, he was an army guy, right? He was the army guy who came in, and he had the backing of the military, and he took over. This guy, Kais Saied, is he's a civilian. He's a civilian person who's in power. He used to be a law professor. So
outsider. He's an outsider.
Yeah, basically. So this is not the same thing. The other thing is that he is, right now, there's a dispute over the constitution. I think as we're talking about the constitution, so Tunisia had a constitution that they drafted in 2014, where the power of the leaders, it was divided, it's supposed to be divided between the presidency and the parliament, right? And then if there were any disputes between the presidency and the parliament, then there was going to be a constitutional court that was going to resolve those disputes. But the court was never established because Kais Saied, the president, who apparently staged a coup, he didn't ratify the bill. But parliament had passed a bill saying that, okay, we've got to establish this constitutional court that's going to resolve disputes between the presidency and the parliament. But that court, the bill was never ratified by Saied. He just said, I'm not going to ratify it. Right. So now he's citing the same constitution in 2014. Where he prevented the establishment of this court to say that he has the power to just suspend parliament the way that he does. So it's that's why I mean that there's a lot of people who are very frustrated with him right now. But again, you know, we don't really know how much support he has. You know, the opposition party, what are they called, Armin? Do you know? And how do you pronounce this? Ennahda, right? So that's they're like a sort of a moderate political Islamic party, right? So they're sort of Islamists. You know, they're obviously upset about this, but you know, they're saying it's a coup. We'll see what happens. I mean, obviously, the story hasn't been resolved.
I do need to remind people that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and the Muslim Brotherhood in Tunisia, and the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza, which is Hamas, they're completely different things, right? Like, these are, just because they're all based on the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't mean that they're the same, as radical as each other, or like they are, you know, it's the same base ideology, but it has resulted in completely different tactics and philosophies and way of governance. So just be mindful of that. I do want us to go talk a little bit about the patron questions. That, so for people who don't know, a lot of patrons can't make it live on air with us, and that's why because the timing that just doesn't work. That's why we made it possible for patrons to be able to send their questions ahead of time. So if you're not a patron and you want to make sure that your questions get answered in any of our live streams, you could become a patron. And when we make the post on Patreon, the questions that are, if you want your questions to be read on air, post your question as a comment under the Patreon post on Patreon. And that way we will make sure that even if you're not here live with us, your questions are answered. Okay. So do you want me to, Ellie, do you want to read the first question?
Okay. Yeah, I'll read the first question. So
Chris,
So it's from Christa Maria Fute, I think. I don't know how to pronounce it, but how is the situation for people living in these areas in general compared to before? I was a supporter of the Arab Spring, but now I think it must be even worse than before, especially for Islam critics like Hamid Abdul Samad and Sharif Gaber. From Libya, you are even rarely hear. From Libya, you even rarely hear anything. Some areas are isolated. So, what is your opinion? So, what is the situation like for people living in these areas in general? That situation is a lot worse. Right? So, yeah, we talked about unemployment among youth. Unemployment among youth was pretty bad before. In like 2012, it was like 31%. Now it's 36.5%. That's over a third of young people are unemployed, and that's causing a tremendous amount of frustration. In addition to, like, you know, what happened recently in the last year and a half when everybody was the pee.
Yeah. Even Tunisia, which is supposed to be the success story, is things are a lot worse than before the Arab Spring. So
yeah,
like everywhere things are horrible. Things are worse than before, right? Yeah. I don't know if you could judge it. With regards to Libya, the reason why people don't, I mean, Libya is like, there's a lot of stuff happening in Libya. The reason why people don't hear much from Libya is because it's just so complicated, right? And the number of external factors and who's on side of what, like what's the role of the French, what is the role of Saudi Arabia, what is the role of United Nations, what is the role of the Trump administration, like everybody was taken aside over the civil war. Seems like it's coming down to, it's making some progress recently. It's coming down, like people are now recognizing a government and all. But I think that the number of factors that we need to do a stream maybe on Libya at some point. We should do a stream specifically on Tunisia and then one on Libya. Yeah,
we'd have to really dig to find information because nobody reports on Libya either that much.
No, there is a lot of reporting on it. It's just that it doesn't get that much clicks because it's just people were like, well, I don't even have the brain power to figure out what's happening. But there are a lot of good reports on it. It just doesn't get that much attention.
There's another aspect of this question about where she asked about Islam critics like Hamid Abdul Samad and Sharif Gaber. So that has been an issue throughout, but you're right that dissidents and political prisoners, there are many, many more times than these political prisoners that are in jail right now, especially in Egypt, than there were before. I mean, political prisoners are at an all-time high in Egypt at the moment. Right, compared to before.
Yeah, but the nature of dissent is not, it's mostly anti people who want freedom it's not anti. It's mostly not, I mean, there is still a lot of people who are maybe critics of Islam. Ali, your beard keeps touching the microphone. That still exists, like critics of Islam or people part of the LGBT community. They're suffering, right? It's not easy at all. Like if you're an ex-Muslim atheist, it's really horrible. And especially if you're part of the LGBT community, it's really tough living in somewhere like Egypt, right? However, let's be quite clear. Like most of the people who are in jail are not that. Like if you want number wise, like the authoritarian and the oppression has increased, but these are somewhat. When I say secular authoritarianism, I'm not saying like these people are not Muslim or that they don't care about Islam or that Islam doesn't influence their behavior. What we're saying is that they're mostly motivated by other things other than Islam. Like, in fact, they are very much against a lot of Islamic parties or Islamic movements, right? So like that's why like somebody like Sisi or Assad is considered like a secular authoritarian, right? So it's like not motivated mostly by religion. So that's what it is. And that's why if you look at the dissent that is being oppressed, it's mostly against like journalists or people who are bringing attention to the corruption of the government. It's not mostly people who are critical of Islam. And so, and again, I'm not saying because they tolerate that. It's just relatively to the, how it just, it's a numbers thing, right? So the pressure against like ex-Muslims or atheists or LGBT community still exists like before, but given how much oppression and exists against all these journalists, I mean, these are record high numbers, right? it just looks relatively small compared to that, right? So I'm not trying to dismiss the bad experience that all these people expose themselves. And another way to look at it, by the way, is that this government does not seem as friendly with, like, there's somewhat of a competition between the influence of the Sisi's government and, for example, Al-Azhar University. I always want to say Zahra because the name comes from Muhammad's daughter, but I don't know why they changed it from Zahra to Al-Azhar. Anyways, from the Al-Azhar University, which is supposed to be the main authority when it comes to everything Islamic in the Sunni world, that happens to be in Egypt. And that's not actually very convenient for an authoritarian, right? So you would think they would be proud of, like, if you're an authoritarian in Egypt, would you be happy that the center of all the most authoritative source of what is Sunni Islam and what is not Sunni Islam exists in your country? That is very inconvenient, right? Because there is such a powerful source of influence on Muslims within and outside of your borders. And for an authoritarian regime that wants to be the main source of power, the only source of power, you see these not as your these Islamic schools not as your allies but as your competitors, right? Especially if you want to refashion, like Sisi also kind of like Ben Salman wants to refashion Islam in a way that supports his regime. And also brings, you know, fights against all the radical movements that could challenge him as well, right? So he wants to have Al-Azhar University that is loyal to maintaining the interests of the government. And if those elements does not exist there, there's going to be some tensions, right? There's going to be some tensions. I mean, some people are bending the knee and folding in Al-Azhar universities, but like there is like a behind the scene, there are things that are happening that we don't know of. I mean, people, you can't just like, you know, both, there's a tension there that, you know, Sisi can't just go in and just be like, you know what, I'm shutting you down. That would be like very unpopular. And they can't also be like, hey, your regime is not Islamic and you shouldn't have the regime. They will also get, you know, they would pay a heavy price for it. So there's just like tension that exists, but also you pretend like it doesn't exist, like you market it as if we're like completely with each other, but you know, there's, yeah, so that's also there's some competition there, but go ahead.
That's fine. I was gonna go and read the second question.
Okay, go on.
So and this is kind of something we've covered. So Claudia is saying, is it a case of, quote, meet the new boss same as the old boss, end quote? It seems like they just mostly wound up with new dictators. When that's
worse, yeah. But Claudia, it's not just new dictators. It's not actually. So you're saying is meet the new boss same as the old boss? It's actually worse. It's worse than the old boss. It's more authoritarian, more oppressive. So yeah. So
yeah, and in that transition between the old boss and the new boss, what they did was they just really, really showed that they can. Just use immense force on their own people. They won't hesitate to do it to keep them down. So they've demonstrated that too.
There are some other comments on the Facebook group by our own friend Mohammed from Egypt. He had a 6-point summary of how he sees it. Do you know which one I'm talking about? So there's a Facebook group specifically for our patrons. And Mohammed, who's from Egypt, do you want to read his summary of what his take?
I'm going to have to open it. Just read it out if you have it in front of you.
Okay, but while I do that, can you remind people who Muhammad is? Because Muhammad...
Muhammad? Nawfal?
Yeah. So like...
Oh, Nawfal is... Yeah, he was a guy who went on... he came out as an atheist on Egyptian national television, right?
Yes.
Right, and he's also like he's also an LGBT activist, and he's part of the LGBT community. And
so his take is going to be so like I really care about his take because he's from Egypt, he's an ex-Muslim atheist, he's an LGBT activist, and he was the most outspoken ex-Muslim atheist on national TV like that I've ever seen, like. I hope everybody here knows his story. Okay. So, because his like, what he did was legendary, right? So
and his previous guest on the podcast, on this podcast. So
yes,
he has been here.
So his view on what happened in Egypt should be it should be very important. Okay, so he's saying in Egypt, we had a military. So number one, we had a military dictatorship under Mubarak. He tried to look modern, but under the table, feed the society Islamic values. Oh, wow. Point number one sounds a lot like Mohammad Reza Shah. Yeah. That's exactly what Mohammad Reza Shah was like. Okay, so point number two. So next stage, Mubarak wanted to give the rule to his son, Gamal, a civilian. Three, the military did not like it and aided the revolution, aka the Arab Spring. So originally, the military was on the side of the revolution. This is actually very interesting. When the military is always, when they want to exert their power, they just decide which protests to support and which. So because it looks too much like a coup if the military themselves get involved and remove the government. So because then it's not the voice of the people. So when military wants to exert power without it being direct, it just chooses to support people or not support the people, depending on the time and depending on their interests. In that way, they're actually doing a coup and enforcing their way on the government without actually looking like they're being anti-populist or like anti the will of the people. But it's still anti the will of the people because they're picking and choosing when to support the people and when to not to. So that was point number two. Then point number three. No, that was point number three. I read that. Point number four. Islamists jumped in and simply won the heart and minds of the uneducated majority. Muhammad sounds very elitist here right now.
He's editorialized it a little bit. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Then number five. I mean, he's right though. Point number five. The military made a good case for why Islamists shouldn't be ruling and how democracy doesn't work good in Egypt because it led to Islamists. So the military was like, guys, democracy, nah, not in Egypt. Look what people choose. They choose the Islamists. So let's not have democracy. So number six, a military coup, and boom, military dictatorship is back. So this is the last point, by the way. So military dictatorship is back and back to square one, but even worse and more brutal and back to feed Islamic values from under the table. So yeah, it's actually, yeah, these military dictatorships, they are feeding, like they are like picking and choosing the Islamists that they support. So it's not like when I say like secular military dictatorships, when I say secular, it doesn't mean that they're not using Islam, right? But that's not their foundation of what they do. And they're picking and choosing. They're choosing the Islamic scholars and the Islamic movements on not based on who has the right Islam, but based on who's willing to bend the knee and who's using Islam as a way to increase, like legitimize this government. Right. So that's the how they operate. Right. So because they're so independent on, you know, whether or not Islam teaches something, but the main criteria is what keeps me in power and what doesn't. In that sense, they're like secular. Like, if you look at, for example, the Islamic Republic of Iran, Islam makes such a much more direct influence on the government than, for example, somebody like Assad or like Sisi. Again, this is not a dismissal of the fact that they do use Islam, by the way. But anyways.
I have a question for you, Armin. Like, what do you think of like this? The Biden administration now, they seem to be pushing more for or calling out human rights violations a lot more than U.S. presidents and administrations have in the past. Like they're doing a lot more. I guess in a way they can. Like they're not dependent on Saudi Arabia for oil, so they'll put pressure on them to release certain political prisoners, which happens. And these dictators are susceptible to pressure. When it comes to Western, like the Western pressure. So is there going to be an effect of this when you have political prisoners in these countries at an all-time high and the youth is very frustrated and a lot of countries are trying to, a lot of dictators are trying to do whatever they can to make sure that the protests don't rise up and it's becoming more and more difficult for them. Do you think that the Biden administration or other Western governments are going to start pushing more and calling out these human rights violations more?
Well, okay, so the Biden administration has made the promise that human rights is going to be one of the main factors in how they decide to do things, okay? And just by announcing that, just by making it such a big deal, is going to make it possible for people to put pressure, some pressure on them when they are not doing that, right? But that pressure, even though it does exist and is going to influence their behavior, it's much lower than the pressure that is going to be on Biden's administration when it comes to requiring stability in the region, right? So the forces that is going to pressure Biden's administration to choose stability is much stronger than the forces that is going to influence Biden's administration to choose human rights. Even though the force for them to choose human rights does exist and it is going to have some effect, just because they made it so that this is a center, this is going to be one of their criteria, right? However, it's not going to be as influential as their desire for stability, right? So, for example, a lot of people would like what is Biden's administration is going to do with Tunisia, right? What about, like, they're not, if, so this is why a lot of times you see that, you know, maybe people who say that they're on the side of human rights, all of a sudden they are either backing dictators or not challenging dictators, right? Because if you do otherwise, it might bring too much instability in the region that you are not, do not have the resources, or the people who voted you in do not have the patience for you to get involved in, right? And that level of instability in the region might force you to get involved with, and that could be a political suicide for you back at home, or it might just, resource wise, you just don't have the budget for it, right? This is why, even though Biden administration has like heavily focused on the fact that they're gonna, you know, make human rights an important criteria for how they operate, they also have said that they want to reduce focus on the Middle East and focus on China, right? And these could be contradictory goals, right? If there is more instability in some regions in the Middle East, the Biden administration might have no choice but to go back and put more focus on certain areas in the Middle East against their own wishes, right? Like, they don't want to. So if, for example, let's say in Tunisia, I don't know what's going to happen in a month or not, right? But if, let's say, democracy completely fails and this is a complete coup, right? Is the Biden administration going to say, oh, this is bad, but at the same time, like, not do anything about it because they're like, we just want stability. We just want stability, man. We just want the Middle East to just take care of itself because we want to get out of here, you know, sooner rather than later. I mean, we're still going to be here always, but less than before, right? So, again, these are contradictory goals in many cases, right? So,
yeah.
And I think if it's a decision between stability and human rights, I think they will choose stability, unless the analysts decide that, you know what, people have spoken, it's coming, this is very shaky, and then maybe like it's gonna fall whether you do it, support it or not. Then in that case, we're like, oh, okay, I guess we're gonna be on the side of human rights in this one, I guess, like, because it's already too late.
Think to close on this, like, I think Susanna's question 1002 is,
well,
probably,
there's a, yes, yeah. Questions, and also we have some comments that I want to highlight as well.
Okay. Yeah, so Susanna's asking a pretty simple question: was it worth it? And I think both of us should answer that. Like, what do you think, Armin? Was it worth it?
I don't think it's for me to decide, because I haven't lost my job, I haven't lost my family member, I haven't have my life improved or. Because some people's lives has improved. Some people are like, some people, a lot more people's lives have you know, not improve and actually done the exact opposite, right? But some people might feel like, you know what, this is a, like Ali said at the beginning of the show, this is 10 years is too short for democracy to win. When you look at history, you see like the struggle against authoritarianism takes longer than just 10 years. And this was the initial stab at it. And it's going to take longer than, you know, you shouldn't give up hope. So some people from these regions might be like, you know what, it was worth it because this was our first try and we're going to keep at it. And some people, but who am I to say it was worth it for somebody who lost a son or a sister or a mother or a father or somebody that used to have a stable job and they can't feed their children, or somebody that lives in Libya and is constantly under the stress of like lack of security, the security that at least maybe they had under Gaddafi. I don't think I'm in a position to be able to decide that if this was worth it or not.
Like, yeah, like big overview, like if you look at it, you know,
it's the big overview is too early to tell. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ask me in 20 years.
Okay, got it. I think that at this point I'm going to slightly lean towards yes, it was worth it, because when you have a situation like this, they tried it out. They saw that there was something possible in some places. It didn't work out everywhere. In some places, they also got an idea of what the cost is. And sometimes you get in Syria, the cost has been tremendous, right? So they know these things. So what the advantage of that, and they know that how the internet and social media and everything was able to power these things. So whenever you have one situation like this that happens, then the next group of people, the next generation or whatever it is, like even younger people, the next group of people who are going to do it, they learn from those lessons and they essentially hone the mechanism and they improve it. I mean, that's just been the natural history of how change happens in the world. So in that sense, I also think it's too early to tell, but I think that part of it, that protest has been normalized, it has been seen, it has produced some results, even though if they were spotty. I think overall that is going to probably pay off in the end.
All right. Music guy is saying steps towards democracy is always worth it. Look at how many times Europe attempted to boot out monarchy and tyrants. Exactly. That's why you can still be somewhat hopeful. But he also says Egypt is going backwards, though. Yep. Like 1600 years back.
Well, I mean, it could be two steps forward, one step back, or one step forward. It could be, you know, we don't know yet. Again, we don't have the projected timeline. It hasn't been long enough.
A music guy is also saying education is so critical to accomplishing democracy. I think a lot of people dismiss how important this is, and this just sounds like a cliche, like, oh yeah, the education, good. But it is actually so correct. This just sounds like a positive thing that people just say just because they're being like, I don't know, romantic about the influence of like rational thinking and education, but it's actually so true. This is like, if this is a cliche, it is for a good reason. This is why when it comes to, you know, even if you're not, if you don't know if, you know, if something is going in the right direction or in the wrong direction, you could just guarantee on just almost, you could just be sure that if you are educating people or informing people, that is going to, in all of these scenarios, it's going to have a positive influence, right? And that's why we do this show, by the way, because that's the only thing that you could be almost certain about, that this, you know, more information, more access to different perspectives, more education, more critical thinking skills, this has a much bigger influence on what these outcomes of anything, of the outcomes of democracy, the outcomes of protests, the outcomes of activism. They are so much influenced by something as simple as better education, which is not simple at all. There is last question that is not relevant at all to the topic, but because we're about to go, we might as well just highlight it.
The multiculturalists are saying, hey guys, have you ever played D&D? That's Dungeons and Dragons. What do you think of a D&D campaign that included Islamic and Christian elements, stories, and characters? What would you think the biggest challenges would be? I'm sorry, I've never played it. I've never played. I haven't, but I'm
so much in favor of this. I will start playing Dungeons and Dragons if it was
if that happens.
This might somebody make this happen. All right. Anyways, anything you want to say? No.
No, I think that's good. Let's see what happens. Let's see what happens in the next 10 years. I am optimistic generally when it comes to these things. So let's see. I'm just really curious. But thank you everybody who joined us and for listening to this. If you're listening to this on audio, do consider going to patreon.com/sjme, becoming a patron for as little as $1 a month, and you'll get 5 episodes or 6 every month. And you'll be able to watch them live. You'll be able to ask questions live. If you can't make it live, you'll be able to ask questions in the Patreon page, and your questions will be read first and addressed first. And if you like what you hear here, if you don't want to become a patron, then please go and rank us on iTunes or what is it? Ratings? Yeah, give us a rating.
Or share our videos on YouTube. Share our videos on YouTube. Not this one, because this is for patrons only, but the short clips and also the audio version, share it on YouTube. That really helps our channel.
Mm-hmm. All right, guys.
Mars is saying thanks for the show as always, fellas. And Music Guy is saying great stream, guys. Bye. Bye. Great question.
Thank you, everybody. Be best.
Be best, everyone. Bye.
See you next time.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends. Write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions. Or head over to secularjihadists.com and give $1 or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you.